The Living Daylight by Ian Fleming. Read by Tom Hiddleston. James Bond lay at the 500-yard firing point of the famous Century Range at Bisley. The white peg in the grass beside him said 4.4, and the same number was repeated high up on the distant butt, above the single 6-foot-square target, that to the human eye, and in the late summer dusk, looked no larger than a postage stamp. But Bond's lens, an infrared sniper scope fixed above his rifle, covered the whole canvas. He could even clearly distinguish the pale blue and beige colours into which the target was divided, and the 6-inch semicircular bull looked as big as the half moon that was already beginning to show, low down in the darkening sky above the distant crest of Chobham Ridges. James Bond's last shot had been an inner left. Not good enough. He took another glance at the yellow and blue wind flags. They were streaming across range from the east, rather more stiffly than when he had begun his shoot half an hour before, and he set 2 clicks more to the right on the wind gauge and traversed the crosswires on the sniper scope back to the point of aim. Then he settled himself, put his trigger finger gently inside the guard and onto the curve of the trigger, shallowed his breathing, and very, very softly squeezed. The vicious crack of the shot boomed across the empty range. The target disappeared below ground, and at once the dummy came up in its place. Yes, the black panel was in the bottom right-hand corner this time, not in the bottom left. A bull. Good, said the voice of the chief range officer from behind and above him. Stay with it. The target was already up again, and Bond put his cheek back to its warm patch on the chunky wooden stock, and his eye to the rubber eyepiece of the scope. He wiped his gun hand down the side of his trousers and took the pistol grip that jutted sharply down below the trigger guard. He splayed his legs an inch more. Now there were to be 5 rounds rapid. It would be interesting to see if that would produce fade. He guessed not. This extraordinary weapon the armourer had somehow got his hands on gave one the feeling that a standing man at a mile would be easy meat. It was mostly a .308 caliber international experimental target rifle, built by Winchester to help American marksmen at world championships, and it had the usual gadgets of super-accurate target weapons. A curled aluminium hand at the back of the butt that extended under the armpit and held the stock firmly into the shoulder, and an adjustable pinion below the rifle's centre of gravity to allow the stock to be nailed into its grooved wooden rest. The armourer had had the usual single-shot bolt action replaced by a 5-shot magazine, and he had assured Bond that if he would allow only 2 seconds between shots to steady the weapon, there would be no fade even at 500 yards. For the job that Bond had to do, he guessed that 2 seconds might be a dangerous loss of time if he missed with his first shot. Anyway, M had said that the range would be not more than 300 yards. Bond would cut it down to 1 second. Almost continuous fire. Ready? Yes. I'll give you a countdown from 5. Now. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire. The ground shuddered slightly and the air sang, as the 5 whirling scraps of cupronickel spat off into the dusk. The target went down, and quickly rose again, decorated with 4 small white discs closely grouped on the bull. There was no 5th disc, not even a black one to show an inner or an outer. The last round was low, said the range officer, lowering his night glasses. Thanks for the contribution. We shift the sand on those butts at the end of every year. Never get less than 15 tons of good lead and copper scrap out of them. Good money. Bond had got to his feet. Corporal Mingies from the armourer's section appeared from the pavilion of the gun club and knelt down to dismantle the Winchester and its rest. He looked up at Bond. He said with a hint of criticism, You were taking it a bit fast, sir. Last round was bound to jump weight. I know, Corporal. I wanted to see how fast I could take it. I'm not blaming the weapon. It's the hell of a fine job. Please tell the armourer so from me. Now I'd better get moving. You're finding your own way back to London, aren't you? Yes. Good night, sir. The chief range officer handed Bond a record of his shoot. 2 sighting shots and then 10 rounds at each 100 yards up to 500. Damn good firing with this visibility. You ought to come back next year and have a bash at the Queen's Prize. It's open to all comers nowadays. British Commonwealth, that is. Thanks. Trouble is, I'm not all that much in England. And thanks for spotting for me. Bond glanced at the distant clock tower. On either side, the red danger flag and the red signal drum were coming down to show that firing had ceased. The hand stood at 9:15. I'd like to have bought you a drink, but I've got an appointment in London. Can we hold it over until that Queen's Prize you were talking about? The range officer nodded noncommittally. He'd been looking forward to finding out more about this man, who'd appeared out of the blue after a flurry of signals from the Ministry of Defence, and had then proceeded to score well over 90% at all distances, and that after the range was closed for the night and visibility was poor to bad. And why had he, who only officiated at the annual July meeting, been ordered to be present? And why had he been told to see that Bond had a 6-inch bull at 500, instead of the regulation 15-inch? And why this flummery with the danger flag and signal drum that were only used on ceremonial occasions? To put pressure on the man? To give an edge of urgency to the shoot? Bond. Commander James Bond. The NRA would surely have a record of anyone who could shoot like that. He'd remember to give them a call. Funny time to have an appointment in London. Probably a girl. The range officer's undistinguished face assumed a disgruntled expression. Sort of fellow who got all the girls he wanted. The two men walked through the handsome facade of Club Row behind the range to Bond's car that stood opposite the bullet-pitted iron reproduction of Landseer's famous Running Deer. Nice-looking job, commented the range officer. Never seen a body like that on a Continental. Have it made specially? Yes. The sports saloons are really only 2-seaters and damn little luggage space. So I got Mulliners to make it into a real 2-seater with plenty of boot. Selfish car, I'm afraid. Well, good night. And thanks again. The exhaust boomed healthily, and the back wheels briefly spat gravel. The chief range officer watched the ruby lights vanish up King's Avenue towards the London Road. He turned on his heel and went to find Corporal Mingus on a search for information that was to prove fruitless. The corporal remained as wooden as the big mahogany box he was in the process of loading into a khaki Land Rover without military symbols. The range officer was a major. He tried pulling his rank without success. The Land Rover hammered away in Bond's wake. The major walked moodily off to the offices of the National Rifle Association to try and find out what he wanted in the library under Bond J. James Bond's appointment was not with a girl. It was with a BEA flight to Hanover and Berlin. As he bit off the miles to London Airport, pushing the big car hard so as to have plenty of time for a drink, 3 drinks, before the takeoff, only part of his mind was on the road. The rest was re-examining, for the umpteenth time, the sequence that was now leading him to an appointment with an aeroplane. But only an interim appointment. His final rendezvous, on one of the next 3 nights in Berlin, was with a man. He had to see this man, and infallibly shoot him dead. When at around 2:30 that afternoon, James Bond had gone in through the double-padded doors and had sat down opposite the turned-away profile on the other side of the big desk, he had sensed trouble. There was no greeting. M's head was sunk into his stiff, turned-down collar in a Churchillian pose of gloomy reflection, and there was a droop of bitterness at the corners of his lips. He swiveled his chair round to face Bond, gave him an appraising glance, as if Bond thought to see that his tie was straight and his hair properly brushed, and then began speaking fast, clipping off his sentences as if he wanted to be rid of what he was saying, and of Bond, as quickly as possible. Number 272. He's a good man. You won't have come across him. Simple reason that he's been holed up in Novaya Zemlya since the war. Now he's trying to get out, loaded with stuff. Atomic and rockets. And their plan for a whole new series of tests for 1961. To put the heat on the West. Something to do with Berlin. Don't quite get the picture, but the FO say if it's true, it's terrific. Makes nonsense of the Geneva Conference and all this blether about nuclear disarmament the communist bloc are putting out. He's got as far as East Berlin, but he's got practically the whole of the KGB on his tail. And the East German security forces, of course. He's holed up somewhere in the city, and he got one message over to us, that he'd be coming across between 6 and 7 p.m. on one of the next three nights, tomorrow, next day, or the day after. He gave the crossing point. Trouble is, the downward curve of M's lips became even more bitter. The courier he used was a double. Station WB bowled him out yesterday, quite by chance. Had a lucky break with one of the KGB codes. The courier will be flown out for trial, of course, but that won't help. The KGB know that 272 will be making a run for it. They know when, they know where. They know just as much as we do, and no more. Now, the code we cracked was a one-day-only setting on their machines. But we got the whole of that day's traffic, and that was good enough. They planned to shoot him on the run, at this street crossing between East and West Berlin he gave us in his message. They're mounting quite an operation. Operation X-Starter, they call it. Put their best sniper on the job. All we know about him is that his code name is the Russian for trigger. Station WB guess he's the same man they've used before for sniper work. Long-range stuff across the frontier. He's going to be guarding this crossing every night, and his job is to get 272. Of course, they'd obviously prefer to do a smoother job with machine guns and what have you, but it's quiet in Berlin at the moment, and apparently the word is it's got to stay so. Anyway, M shrugged. They've got confidence in this trigger operator, and that's the way it's going to be. Where do I come in, sir? James Bond had guessed the answer. Guessed why M was showing his dislike of the whole business. This was going to be dirty work, and Bond, because he belonged to the 00 section, had been chosen for it. Perversely, Bond wanted to force M to put it in black and white. This was going to be bad news, dirty news, and he didn't want to hear it from one of the section officers or even from the chief of staff. This was to be murder. All right. Let M bloody well say so. Where do you come in, 007? M looked coldly across the desk. You know where you come in. You've got to kill this sniper. And you've got to kill him before he gets 272. That's all. Is that understood? The clear blue eyes remained cold as ice. But Bond knew that they remained so only with an effort of will. M didn't like sending any man to a killing. But when it had to be done, he always put on this fierce, cold act of command. Bond knew why. It was to take some of the pressure, some of the guilt, off the killer's shoulders. So now Bond, who knew these things, decided to make it easy and quick for M. He got to his feet. That's all right, sir. I suppose the chief of staff has got all the gen. I'd better go and put in some practice. It wouldn't do to miss. He walked to the door. M said quietly, sorry to have to hand this to you. Nasty job. But it's got to be done well. I'll do my best, sir. James Bond walked out and closed the door behind him. He didn't like the job, but on the whole he'd rather have it himself than have the responsibility of ordering someone else to go and do it. The chief of staff had been only a shade more sympathetic. "Sorry you bought this one, James," he had said. "But Tanqueray was definite that he hadn't got anyone good enough on his station. And it isn't the sort of job you can ask a regular soldier to do. Plenty of top marksmen in the BAOR, but a live target needs another kind of nerve. Anyway, I've been on to Bisley and fixed a shoot for you tonight, at 8:15 when the ranges will be closed. Visibility should be about the same as you'll be getting in Berlin around an hour earlier. The armourer's got the gun, a real target job, and he's sending it down with one of his men. You'll find your own way. Then you're booked on a midnight BEA charter flight to Berlin. Take a taxi to this address." He handed Bond a piece of paper. "Go up to the fourth floor and you'll find Tanqueray's number 2 waiting for you. Then I'm afraid you'll just have to sit it out for the next 3 days." "How about the gun? Am I supposed to take it through the German customs in the golf bag or something?" The chief of staff hadn't been amused. "It'll go over in the FO bag. You'll have it by tomorrow midday." He had reached for a signal pad. "Well, you better get cracking. I'll just let Tanqueray know everything's fixed." James Bond glanced down at the dim blue face of the dashboard clock. 10:15. With any luck, by this time tomorrow it would all be finished. After all, it was the life of this man Trigger against the life of 272. It wasn't exactly murder. Pretty near it, though. He gave a vicious blast on his triple windhorns at an inoffensive family saloon, took the roundabout in a quite unnecessary dry skid, wrenched the wheel harshly to correct it, and pointed the nose of the Bentley towards the distant glow that was London Airport. The ugly six-story building at the corner of Kochstrasse and the Wilhelmstrasse was the only one standing in a waste of empty, bombed space. Bond paid off his taxi and got a brief impression of waist-high weeds and half-tidied rubble walls, stretching away to a big deserted crossroads lit by a central cluster of yellowish arc lamps, before he pushed the bell for the fourth floor and at once heard the click of the door opener. The door closed itself behind him, and he walked over the uncarpeted cement floor to the old-fashioned lift. The smell of cabbage, cheap cigar smoke, and stale sweat reminded him of other apartment houses in Germany and Central Europe. Even the sigh and faint squeal of the slow lift were part of 100 assignments when he'd been fired off by M like a projectile at some distant target where a problem waited for his coming, waited to be solved by him. At least this time, the reception committee was on his side. This time there was nothing to fear at the top of the stairs. Number 2 of Secret Service Station WB was a lean, tense man in his early 40s. He wore the uniform of his profession, well-cut, well-used, lightweight tweeds and a dark green herringbone, a soft white silk shirt and an old-school tie, in his case, Wickhamist. At the sight of the tie, and while they exchanged conventional greetings in the small, musty lobby of the apartment, Bond's spirits, already low, sank another degree. He knew the type. Backbone of the civil service. Overcrammed and underloved at Winchester. A good second in PPE at Oxford. The war, staff jobs he would have done meticulously, perhaps an OBE. Allied Control Commission in Germany, where he'd been recruited into the I branch, and thence, because he was the ideal staff man and A1 with security. And because he thought he would find life, drama, romance, the things he had never had, into the Secret Service. A sober, careful man had been needed to chaperone Bond on this ugly business. Captain Paul Sender, late of the Welsh Guards, had been the obvious choice. He'd bought it. Now, like a good Wickhamist, he concealed his distaste for the job beneath careful, trite conversation as he showed Bond the layout of the apartment and the arrangements that had been made for the executioner's preparedness and to a modest extent, his comfort. The flat consisted of a large double bedroom, a bathroom, and a kitchen containing tinned food, milk, butter, eggs, tea, bacon, bread, and one bottle of Dimple Hague. The only odd feature in the bedroom was that one of the double beds was angled up against the curtains covering the single broad window and was piled high with three mattresses below the bedclothes. Captain Sender said, "Care to have a look at the field of fire? Then I can explain what the other side have in mind." Bond was tired. He didn't particularly want to go to sleep with the picture of the battlefield on his mind. He said, "That'd be fine." Captain Sender switched off the lights. Chinks from the street light at the intersection showed round the curtains.
"Don't want to draw the curtains," said Captain Sender. "Unlikely, but they may be on the lookout for a covering party for 272. If you just lie on the bed and get your head under the curtains, I'll brief you about what you'll be looking at. Look to the left."
It was a sash window and the bottom half was open. The mattress, by design, gave only a little, and James Bond found himself more or less in the firing position he'd been in on the Century Range, but now staring across broken, thickly weeded bombed ground towards the bright river of the Zimmerstrasse, the border with East Berlin. It looked about 150 yards away. Captain Sender's voice from above him and behind the curtain began reciting. It reminded Bond of a spiritualist seance.
"That's bombed ground in front of you, plenty of cover, 130 yards of it up to the frontier, then the frontier, the street, and then a big stretch of more bombed ground on the enemy side. That's why 272 chose this route. It's one of the few places in the town which is broken land, thick weeds, ruined walls, cellars, on both sides of the frontier. He will sneak through that mess on the other side and make a dash across the Zimmerstrasse for the mess on our side. Trouble is, he'll have 30 yards of brightly lit frontier to sprint across. That'll be the killing ground. Right?"
Bond said, "Yes." He said it softly. The scent of the enemy, the need to take care, already had him by the nerves.
"To your left, that big new 10-story block is the Haus der Ministerien, the chief brain centre of East Berlin. You can see the lights are still on in most of the windows. Most of those will stay on all night. These chaps work hard, shifts all round the clock. You probably won't need to worry about the lighted ones. This trigger chap will almost certainly fire from one of the dark windows. You'll see there's a block of four together on the corner above the intersection. They've stayed dark last night and tonight. They've got the best field of fire. From here, their range varies from 300 to 310 yards. I've got all the figures and so on when you want them. You needn't worry about much else. That street stays empty during the night. Only the motorized patrols about every half an hour. Light armored car with a couple of motorcycles as escort. Last night, which I suppose is typical, between 6 and 7 when this thing's going to be done, there were a few people that came and went out of that side door. Civil servant types. Before that, nothing out of the ordinary. Usual flow of people in and out of a busy government building. Except, of all things, a whole damned women's orchestra. Made the hell of a racket in some concert hall they've got in there. Part of the block is the Ministry of Culture. Otherwise nothing. Certainly none of the KGB people we know, nor any signs of preparation for a job like this. But there wouldn't be. They're careful chaps, the opposition. Anyway, have a good look. Don't forget it's darker than it will be tomorrow around 6, but you can get the general picture."
Bond got the general picture, and it stayed with him long after the other man was asleep and snoring softly with a gentle regular clicking sound. A wicker mist snore, Bond reflected irritably. Yes, he had got the picture. The picture of a flicker of movement among the shadowy ruins on the other side of the gleaming river of light. A pause. Then the wild zigzagging sprint of a man in the full glare of the arcs. The crash of gunfire. And either a crumpled, sprawling heap in the middle of the wide street, or the noise of his onward dash through the weeds and rubble of the western sector. Sudden death or a home run. The true gauntlet. How much time would Bond have to spot the Russian sniper in one of those dark windows and kill him? 5 seconds? 10? When dawn edged the curtains with gunmetal, Bond capitulated to his fretting mind. It had won. He went softly into the bathroom and surveyed the ranks of medicine bottles that a thoughtful Secret Service had provided to keep its executioner in good shape. He selected the Tuinal, chased down two of the ruby and blue depth charges with a glass of water, and went back to bed. Then, poleaxed, he slept. He awoke at midday. The flat was empty. Bond drew the curtains to let in the grey Prussian day, and standing well back from the window, gazed out at the drabness of Berlin and listened to the tram noises and to the distant screeching of the U-Bahn as it took the big curve into the Zoo station. He gave a quick reluctant glance at what he had examined the night before, noted that the weeds among the bomb rubble were much the same as the London ones. Rose bay willow herb, dock and bracken, and then went into the kitchen. There was a note propped against a loaf of bread. "My friend," a Secret Service euphemism which in this context meant sender's chief, "says it's all right for you to go out, but to be back by 1700 hours. Your gear," double talk for Bond's rifle, "has arrived, and the Batman will lay it out this PM. P-sender." Bond lit the gas cooker, burned the message with a sneer at his profession, then brewed himself a vast dish of scrambled eggs and bacon, which he heaped on buttered toast and washed down with black coffee, into which he'd poured a liberal tot of whisky. Then he bathed and shaved, dressed in the drab, anonymous, middle European clothes he'd brought over for the purpose, looked at his disordered bed, decided to hell with it, and went down in the lift and out of the building. James Bond had always found Berlin a glum, inimical city, dry varnished on the western side with a brittle veneer of gimcrack polish, rather like the chromium trim on American motor cars. He walked to the Kurfürstendamm, sat in the Café Markwart, drank an espresso, and moodily watched the obedient queues of pedestrians waiting for the go sign on the traffic lights, while the shiny stream of cars went through their dangerous quadrille at the busy intersection. It was cold outside, and the sharp wind from the Russian steppes whipped at the girls' skirts and at the waterproofs of the impatient, hurrying men, each with the inevitable briefcase tucked under his arm. The infrared wall heaters in the café glared redly down and gave a spurious glow to the faces of the café squatters, consuming their traditional one cup of coffee and 10 glasses of water, reading the free newspapers and periodicals in their wooden racks, or earnestly bent over business documents. Bond, closing his mind to the evening, debated with himself about ways to spend the afternoon. It finally came down to a choice between a visit to that respectable-looking brownstone house in the Klausfurtstrasse, known to all concierges and taxi drivers, or a trip to the Wannsee and a strenuous walk in the Grunewald. Virtue triumphed. Bond paid for his coffee, went out into the cold, and took a taxi to the Zoo station. The pretty young trees round the long lake had already been touched by the breath of autumn, and there was occasional gold amongst the green. Bond walked hard for 2 hours along the leafy paths, then chose a restaurant with a glassed-in veranda above the lake, and greatly enjoyed a high tea, consisting of a double portion of Matthias herring smothered in cream and onion rings, and 2 Moller mit Korn, the Berlin equivalent of a boilermaker and his assistant. Schnapps, doubles, washed down with draft Löwenbräu. Then, feeling more encouraged, he took the S-Bahn back into the city. Outside the apartment house, a nondescript young man was tinkering with the engine of a black Opel Capitan. He didn't take his head out from under the bonnet when Bond passed close by him and went up to the door and pressed the bell. Captain Sender was reassuring. It was a friend, a corporal from the transport section of Station WB. He'd fixed up some bad engine trouble on the Opel. Each night, from 6 to 7, he'd be ready to produce a series of multiple backfires when a signal on a walkie-talkie operated by Sender told him to do so. This would give some kind of cover for the noise of Bond's shooting. Otherwise, the neighbourhood might alert the police and there would be a lot of untidy explaining to be done. Their hideout was in the American sector, and while their American friends had given Station WB clearance for this operation, the friends were naturally anxious that it should be a clean job and without repercussions. Bond was suitably impressed by the car gimmick, as he was by the very workmanlike preparations that had been made for him in the living room. Here, behind the head of his high bed, giving a perfect firing position, a wood and metal stand had been erected against the broad windowsill, and along it lay the Winchester, the tip of its barrel just denting the curtains. The wood and all the metal parts of the rifle and sniper scope had been painted a dull black, and laid out on the bed like sinister evening clothes was a black velvet hood, stitched to a waist-length shirt of the same material. The hood had wide slits for the eyes and mouth. It reminded Bond of old prints of the Spanish Inquisition, or of the anonymous operators on the guillotine platform during the French Revolution. There was a similar hood on Captain Sender's bed, and on his section of the windowsill there lay a pair of night glasses and the microphone for the walkie-talkie. Captain Sender, his face worried and tense with nerves, said there was no news at the station, no change in the situation as they knew it. Did Bond want anything to eat? Or a cup of tea? Perhaps a tranquilizer. There were several kinds in the bathroom. Bond stitched a cheerful, relaxed expression on his face and said no thanks, and gave a light-hearted account of his day, while an artery near his solar plexus began thumping gently as tension built up inside him like a watch spring tightening. Finally, his small talk petered out, and he lay down on his bed with the German thriller he had bought on his wanderings, while Captain Sender moved fretfully about the flat, looking too often at his watch and chain-smoking Kent filter tips through, he was a careful man, a Dunhill filter holder. James Bond's choice of reading matter, prompted by a spectacular jacket of a half-naked girl strapped to a bed, turned out to have been a happy one for the occasion. It was called Verdert, Verdammt, Verraten. The prefix fair signified that the girl had not only been ruined, damned, and betrayed, but that she'd suffered these misfortunes most thoroughly. James Bond temporarily lost himself in the tribulations of the heroine, Gräfin Liselotte Mützenbacher, and it was with irritation that he heard Captain Sender say that it was 5:30 and time to take up their positions. Bond took off his coat and tie, put 2 sticks of chewing gum in his mouth and donned the hood. The lights were switched off by Captain Sender, and Bond lay along the bed, got his eye to the eyepiece of the sniper scope, and gently lifted the bottom edge of the curtain back and over his shoulders. Now dusk was approaching, but otherwise the scene, a year later to become famous as Checkpoint Charlie, was like a well-remembered photograph. The wasteland in front of him, the bright river over the frontier road, the farther wasteland and on the left, the ugly square block of the Haus der Ministerien, with its lit and dark windows. Bond scanned it all slowly, moving the sniper scope with the rifle by means of the precision screws on the wooden base. It was all the same, except that now there was a trickle of personnel leaving and entering the ministry through the door onto the Wilhelmstrasse. Bond looked along at the 4 dark windows, dark again tonight, that he agreed with Sender with the enemy's firing points. The curtains were drawn back, and the sash windows were wide open at the bottom. Bond's scope could not penetrate into the rooms, but there was no sign of movement within the 4 oblong, black, gaping mouths. Now there was extra traffic in the street below. The women's orchestra came trooping down the pavement towards the entrance, 20 laughing, talking girls carrying their instruments. Violin and wind instrument cases, satchels with their scores, and 4 of them with the drums. A gay, happy little crocodile. Bond was reflecting that some people still seem to find life fun in the Soviet sector. When his glasses picked out and stayed on the girl carrying the cello, Bond's masticating jaws stopped still and then reflectively went on with their chewing as he twisted the screw to depress the sniper scope and keep her in its center. The girl was taller than the others, and her long, straight, fair hair falling to her shoulders shone like molten gold under the arcs at the intersection. She was hurrying along in a charming, excited way, carrying the cello case as if it were no heavier than a violin. Everything was flying. The skirt of her coat, her feet, her hair. She was vivid with movement and life, and it seemed with gaiety and happiness as she chattered to the 2 girls who flanked her and laughed back at what she was saying. As she turned in at the entrance amidst her troop, the arcs momentarily caught a beautiful, pale profile. And then she was gone. And it seemed to Bond, with her disappearance, a stab of grief lanced into his heart. How odd. How very odd. This had not happened to him since he was young. And now this single girl, seen only indistinctly and far away, had caused him to suffer this sharp pang of longing, this thrill of animal magnetism. Morosely, Bond glanced down at the luminous dial of his watch. 5:50. Only 10 minutes to go. No transport arriving at the entrance. None of those anonymous black Zik saloons he'd half expected. He closed as much of his mind as he could to the girl and sharpened his wits. Get on, damn you. Get back to your job. From somewhere inside the ministry there came the familiar sounds of an orchestra tuning up, the strings tuning their instruments to single notes on the piano, the sharp blare of individual woodwinds, then a pause, and then the collective crash of melody as the whole orchestra threw itself competently, so far as Bond could judge, into the opening bars of what even to James Bond was vaguely familiar. "The Polovtsian dances from Prince Igor," said Captain Sanders succinctly. "Anyway, 6 o'clock coming up," and then urgently, "Hey, right-hand bottom of the 4 windows, watch out!" Bond minutely depressed the sniper scope. Yes. There was movement inside the black cave. Now, from the interior, a thick black object, a weapon, had slid out. It moved firmly, minutely, swiveling down and sideways so as to cover the stretch of the Zimmerstrasse between the 2 wastelands of rubble. Then the unseen operator in the room behind seemed satisfied, and the weapon remained still, fixed, obviously, to a stand such as Bond had beneath his rifle.
"What is it? What sort of gun?"
Captain Sender's voice was more breathless than it should have been. "Take it easy, damn it," thought Bond. "It's me who's supposed to have the nerves." He strained his eyes, taking in the squat flash eliminator at the muzzle, the telescopic sight, and thick downward chunk of magazine. Yes, that would be it. Absolutely for sure. And the best they had. "Kalashnikov," he said curtly. "Submachine gun. Gas-operated. 30 rounds in 7.62mm. Favorite with the KGB. They're going to do a saturation job after all. Perfect for range. We'll have to get in pretty quick or 272 will end up not just dead, but strawberry jam. You keep an eye out for any movement over there in the rubble. I'll have to stay married to that window and the gun. He'll have to show himself to fire. Other chaps are probably spotting behind him, perhaps from all 4 windows. Much the sort of setup we expected. But I didn't think they'd use a weapon that's going to make all the racket this one will. I should have known they would. A running man would be hard to get in this light with a single-shot job. Bond fiddled minutely with the traversing and elevating screws at his fingertips and got the fine lines of the scope exactly intersected, just behind where the butt of the enemy gun merged into the blackness behind. Get the chest. Don't bother about the head. Inside the hood, Bond's face began to sweat, and his eye socket was slippery against the rubber of the eyepiece. That didn't matter. It was only his hands, his trigger finger, that must stay bone dry. As the minutes ticked by, he frequently blinked his eyes to rest them, shifted his limbs to keep them supple, listened to the music to relax his mind. The minutes slouched on leaden feet. How old would she be? Early 20s, say 23. With that poise and insouciance, the hint of authority in her long, easy stride, she would come of good racy stock, one of the old Prussian families, probably, or from similar remnants in Poland or even Russia. Why in hell did she have to choose the cello? There was something almost indecent in the idea of that bulbous, ungainly instrument between her splayed thighs. Of course, Sujia had managed to look elegant, and so did that girl Amaryllis somebody. But they should invent a way for women to play the damn thing side-saddle. At his side, Captain Sender said, 7 o'clock. Nothing stirred on the other side. Bit of movement on our side. Near a cellar close to the frontier. That'll be our reception committee. 2 good men from the station. Better stay with it until they close down. Let me know when they take that gun in. All right. It was 7:30 when the KGB submachine gun was gently drawn back into the black interior. One by one, the bottom sashes of the 4 windows were closed. The cold-hearted game was over for the night. 272 was still holed up. 2 more nights to go. Bond softly drew the curtain over his shoulders and across the muzzle of the Winchester. He got up, pulled off his cowl and went into the bathroom and stripped and had a shower. Then he had 2 large whiskies on the rocks in quick succession, while he waited, his ears pricked, for the now muffled sound of the orchestra to stop. When, at 8 o'clock, it did, with the expert comment from Sender, Borodin's Prince Igor, choral dance number 17, I think. He said to Sender, who had been getting off his report in garbled language to the head of station, Just going to have another look. I've rather taken to that tall blonde with the cello. Didn't notice her, said Sender, uninterested. He went into the kitchen. Tea, guessed Bond. Or perhaps Horlicks. Bond donned his cowl, went back to his firing position, and depressed the sniper scope to the doorway of the ministry. Yes, there they went. Not so gay and laughing now. Tired, perhaps. And now here she came. Less lively, but still with that beautiful, careless stride. Bond watched the blown golden hair in the fawn raincoat until it had vanished into the indigo dusk up the Wilhelmstrasse. Where did she live? In some miserable, flaked room in the suburbs? Or in one of the privileged apartments in the hideous, lavatory-tiled Stalinallee? Bond drew himself back. Somewhere, within easy reach, that girl lived. Was she married? Did she have a lover? Anyway, to hell with it. She was not for him. The next day and the next night watch were duplicates, with small variations, of the first. James Bond had 2 more brief rendezvous by sniper scope with the girl, and the rest was a killing of time and a tightening of the tension that by the time the 3rd and final day came, was like a fog in the small room. James Bond crammed the 3rd day with an almost lunatic program of museums, art galleries, the zoo and a film, hardly perceiving anything he looked at, his mind's eye divided between the girl and those 4 black squares, and the black tube, and the unknown man behind it, the man he was now certainly going to kill tonight. Back in the apartment, punctually at 5, Bond narrowly averted a row with Captain Sender because he'd poured himself a stiff whiskey before putting on the hideous cowl that now stank of his sweat. Captain Sender had tried to prevent him, and when he failed, had threatened to call up head of station and report Bond for breaking training.
"Look, my friend," said Bond wearily, "I've got to commit a murder tonight, not you, me. So be a good chap and stuff it, would you? You can tell Tanker anything you like when it's over. Think I like this job? Having a 00 number and so on? I'd be quite happy for you to get me sacked from the 00 section. Then I could settle down and make a snug nest of papers as an ordinary staffer. Right?"
Bond drank down his whiskey, reached for his thriller, now arriving at an appalling climax, and threw himself on the bed. Captain Sender, icily silent, went off into the kitchen to brew, from the sounds, his inevitable cuppa. Bond felt the whiskey beginning to melt the coiled nerves in his stomach. "Now then, Lieselotte, how in hell are you going to get out of this fix?" It was exactly 6:05 when Sender, at his post, began talking excitedly.
"Bond! There's something moving way back over there. How he's stopped. Wait. No. He's on the move again. Keeping low. There's a bit of broken wall there. He'll be out of sight of the opposition, but thick weeds, yards of them ahead of him. Christ, he's coming through the weeds. And they're moving. Hope to God they think it's only the wind. Now he's through and gone to ground. Any reaction?"
"No," said Bond tensely. "Keep on telling me. How far to the frontier?"
"He's only got about 50 yards to go."
Captain Sender's voice was harsh with excitement.
"Broken stuff, but some of it's open. Then a solid chunk of wall right up against the pavement. He'll have to get over it. He can't fail to spot him then. Now! Now he's made 10 yards and another 10. Got him clearly then. Blackened his face and hands. Get ready! Any moment now we'll make his last sprint."
James Bond felt the sweat pouring down his face and neck. He took a chance and quickly wiped his hands down his sides, and then got them back to the rifle, his finger inside the guard, just lying along the curved trigger. "There's something moving in the room behind the gun. They must have spotted him. Get that opal working." Bond heard the code word go into the microphone, heard the opal in the street below start up, felt his pulse quicken as the engine leapt into life, and a series of ear-splitting cracks came from the exhaust. The movement in the black cave was now definite. A black arm with a black glove had reached out and under the stock.
"Now!" ejaculated Captain Sender. "Now! He's run for the wall! He's up it! Just go to jump!"
And then, in the sniper scope, Bond saw the head of Trigger. The purity of the profile, the golden bell of hair, all laid out along the stock of the Kalashnikov. She was dead. A sitting duck. Bond's fingers flashed down to the screws, inched them round, and as yellow flame fluttered at the snout of the submachine gun, squeezed the trigger. The bullet, dead on at 310 yards, must have hit where the stock ended up the barrel. Might have got her in the left hand, but the effect was to tear the gun off its mountings, smash it against the side of the window frame, and then hurl it out of the window. It turned several times on its way down and crashed into the middle of the street.
"He's over!"
shouted Captain Sender.
"He's over! He's done it! By God, he's done it!"
"Get down!"
said Bond sharply, and threw himself sideways off the bed as the big eye of a searchlight in one of the black windows blazed on, swerving up the street towards their block and their room. Then gunfire crashed and the bullets howled into their window, ripping the curtains, smashing the woodwork, thudding into the walls. Behind the roar and zing of the bullets, Bond heard the opal race off down the street, and behind that again, the fragmentary whisper of the orchestra. The combination of the two background noises clicked. Of course. The orchestra had probably raised an infernal din throughout the house de ministerian, having been used, like the backfiring opal on this side, to provide some cover for a sharp burst of fire on their side by Trigger. Had she carried her weapon to and fro every day in that cello case? Was the whole orchestra composed of KGB women? Had the other instrument cases contained only equipment? The big drum, perhaps the searchlight, while the real instruments were available in the concert hall. Too elaborate? Too fantastic? Probably. But there had been no doubt about the girl. In the sniper scope, Bond had even been able to see one wide, heavily lashed, aiming eye. Had he hurt her? Almost certainly her left arm. There would be no chance of seeing her, seeing how she was, if she left with the orchestra. Now he would never see her again. Their window would be a death trap. To underline the fact, a stray bullet smashed into the mechanism of the Winchester, already overturned and damaged, and hot lead splashed down on Bond's hand, burning the skin. On Bond's emphatic oath, abruptly the firing stopped, and silence sang in the room. Captain Sender emerged from beside his bed, brushing glass out of his hair. They crunched across the floor and through the splintered door into the kitchen. Here, because it faced away from the street, it was safe to switch on the light. "Any damage?" asked Bond.
"No. You all right?"
Captain Sender's pale eyes were bright with the fever that comes in battle. They also, Bond noticed, held a sharp glint of accusation. "Yes, just get an elastoplast for my hand. Caught a splash from one of the bullets." Bond went into the bathroom. When he came out, Captain Sender was sitting by the walkie-talkie he had fetched from the sitting room. He was speaking into it. "Now," he said into the microphone, "that's all for now. Fine about 272. Hurry the armoured car, if you would. Be glad to get out of here. And 007 will need to write his version of what happened. Okay? Then over and out." Captain Sender turned to Bond. Half accusing, half embarrassed, he said, "Afraid head of station needs your reasons in writing for not getting that chap. I had to tell him I'd seen you alter your aim at the last second. Gave Trigger time to get off a burst. Damn lucky for 272, he'd just begun his sprint. Blew chunks off the wall behind him. What was it all about?"
James Bond knew he could lie. Knew he could fake a dozen reasons why. Instead, he took a deep pull at the strong whiskey he had poured for himself, put the glass down, and looked Captain Sender straight in the eye. Trigger was a woman.
"So what? KGB have got plenty of women agents and women gunners. I'm not in the least surprised. The Russian women's team always does well in the World Championships. Last meeting in Moscow, they came first, second and third against seven countries. I can even remember two of their names, Donskaya and Lomova. Terrific shots. She may even have been one of them. What does she look like? Records will probably be able to turn her up."
She was a blonde. She was the girl who carried the cello in that orchestra. Probably had her gun in the cello case. The orchestra was to cover up the shooting.
"Oh," said Captain Sender slowly. "I see. The girl you were keen on."
"That's right."
"Well, I'm sorry, but I'll have to put that in my report too. You had clear orders to exterminate Trigger."
There came the sound of a car approaching. It pulled up somewhere below. The bell rang twice. Sender said,
"Well, let's get going. They've sent an armoured car to get us out of here."
He paused. His eyes flicked over Bond's shoulder, avoiding Bond's eyes.
"Sorry about the report. Got to do my duty, you know. You should have killed that sniper, whoever it was."
Bond got up. He suddenly didn't want to leave the stinking little smashed-up flat. Leave the place from which, for 3 days, he had had this long-range, one-sided romance with an unknown girl. An unknown enemy agent, with much the same job in her outfit as he had in his. Poor little bitch. She would be in worse trouble now than he was. She'd certainly be court-martialed for muffing this job. Probably be kicked out of the KGB. He shrugged. At least they'd stop short of killing her, as he himself had done. James Bond said wearily, "Okay. With any luck, it'll cost me my 00 number. But tell head of station not to worry. That girl won't do any more sniping. Probably lost a left hand. Certainly broke a nerve for that kind of work. Scared the living daylights out of her. In my book, that was enough. Let's go." The Living Daylights was produced for Ian Fleming Publications by Lucy Fleming and directed by Enid Williams. It was first published in 1962. These stories were first published as a collection in 1966. Ian Fleming died in 1964.